I think Bill Buckley was the one who said that libertarian brew is bracing when sipped and lethal when swallowed whole. I'm afraid that's the way too many Muslims view it.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with the founder and president of the Minaret of Freedom Institute, Imad ad-Din Ahmed. Dean, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Nick.
Okay, and I hope to pronounce your name correctly on the way out if I didn't on the way in. The Minaret of Freedom Institute started in 1993, and you designed it so that it combats distortions of Islam to Americans or to the wider world, while also explaining to Muslims that a kind of libertarian sensibility and free market economics are perfectly compatible with the Quran and the Muslim faith. Talk a little bit about why you started this institute.
Well, originally it was in the aftermath of the Iranian Revolution that the experts who had not seen it coming and consequently their retroactive explanations of it were totally incoherent. I felt that somebody who actually, you know, was involved and engagé of Islam needed to get involved in the process of dealing with these things. So I began to write books and articles and give lectures about this. And in the early 1990s, under the encouragement of a libertarian think tank in Turkey, realized that it would be very helpful to those people who are trying to fight for liberty in the Muslim world to have an organization like ours.
In the Muslim world, what is the biggest misconception or fear of a kind of free market system?
The biggest fear in the Muslim world is the association in their minds of free markets with imperialism. Mm-hmm. And of course, those of us familiar with the history of libertarian thought know that true devotees of free markets have always been opposed to imperialism. But the fact
is, Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations is a critique of the mercantilism that the English Empire was using to take over many parts of the world, including some Muslim parts.
That's right. From the viewpoint of people who are living in the Muslim world today, what they see are dictatorial regimes who are often allied with the West and see the West coming in and engaging in a kind of neo-imperialism where they're taking out the raw materials and producing finished goods, which they then sell back to the countries and exploiting all the resources. And not realizing that what a true free market, they would be allowed to develop their own industries.
Are there Muslim countries that are doing particularly well in embracing a kind of free market globalization model that is working for the home countries as well as growing good contacts with either the West or the developed world or other parts of the Muslim world?
There are several who have. One of the most notable successes for a long time was Malaysia, when Anwar Ibrahim was in the government there. The most successful one today is probably Turkey, which went from a situation where they had 100% inflation rate into a situation where now they've got a sound currency, they've got a vibrant domestic economy, they have trade with a number of nations, have been doing economically very well indeed.
The other side, a lot of Western economists, whether they're in Europe or in the United States, often will say, well, look, you know, one of the reasons why Muslim countries, especially in the Middle East, are so backwards is that the Quran forbids the use of interest, or that you really can't have a modern banking system, and that, Arabs created the concept of zero, but ever since then, they haven't been able to do basic math. How do you combat that looking towards an American audience?
Yeah, well, that is a problem. You know, it was the Muslim civilization that also created the check.
Right.
So to say that it's opposed to modern banking is a little bit limited.
Right.
I have to say that I personally, and I'm in a minority among Muslim thinkers on this point, I do not believe that the Quranic prohibition on what's called riba, which is a form of overcharging, and which has been used to refer to usury, applies to all interest. But having said that, I am in the minority. It's interesting to me, though, that among economists, most are not bothered by this because a technical prohibition on interest is so easily gotten around, money being so fungible. Also, it has to be understood that the prohibition on interest is not a prohibition on all interest, but only a prohibition on interest on loans. Therefore, when a merchant wants to give a church surcharge for credit or a discount for cash, that is, according to most scholars, the overwhelming majority of scholars, that is perfectly permissible. So the result is that you can get around this prohibition on interest-only loans by various techniques, some legitimate, some trickery. But an example of a legitimate method is the so-called Islamic mortgage. You want to buy a house, you don't have the money to buy the house, so you and I become partners in the house purchase. We buy the house together, you pay me rent for my share, and over time you buy out my share. Although there is obviously an implied interest here, it's considered totally permissible because it's a business deal and not
so a loan. Whatever else we can say, there is nothing inherent in the Quran or in Islam that prevents Muslim majority countries from joining the world economy.
Well, absolutely not, yeah. And you can see how many of them have. Not just Turkey, Malaysia, Indonesia, yeah. But even the ones where they have a very conservative interpretation mm-hmm. of the religious law, like Saudi Arabia, you know, it has a huge development bank. And while some people may say that their methods of getting around the interest prohibition are trickery, nonetheless, it's there.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Syria. This is a kind of issue that is, you know, on the front burner in the United States. I mean, it's among libertarians in the United States, I mean, it's pretty clear the way that Barack Obama was talking about wanting to really engage or intervene in the Syrian war last August. If it hadn't been for people like Rand Paul, the libertarian-leaning Republican, we may well have been on bombing runs by now. What is the best thing that, from your perspective, what is the best thing that the United States can do vis-a-vis the Syrian war?
Well, I think that the United States has to maintain a non-interventionist policy in Syria while at the same time continuing to exert moral leadership. And that moral leadership can manifest itself in pressure on those Gulf states that have been putting a negative impact on Syria by funding, well, terrorists to engage in the rebellion. I think you have to understand how Syria got into the mess it's in today. First off, the Assad regime is a terrible regime. He's one of the worst despots in the world. And the initial demonstrations against him, which were peaceful demonstrations, were largely effective because they caused people from the Assad regime, people with consciences, to desert the regime. But when foreigners, unfortunately including the United States,
right. And this also includes, you know, Iraqis, it includes Iranians, it includes Russians, it includes
and
Turks.
And the Saudis, yeah. and the Qataris.
Right.
That intervention on one side or the other,
right.
Certainly the Russians and the Iranians supporting Assad, the Qataris and the Saudis, sending in fighters to support the rebels. And the Americans and the Germans providing intelligence support to the rebels all encouraged them to go militant. Mm-hmm. And once they went militant, of course, the Alawites, who are a minority mm-hmm. in the country.
And this is Assad's group.
This is Assad's group. Group. Yeah. As well as those groups whom he had made alliances with, like the Christians,
right.
all feel threatened by these extremists who are coming in to side with the rebels, and so they've closed forces in support of the Assad regime. And that is essentially what led to this horrible civil war that's going on now.
So then, I mean, given that, and you say exert moral leadership, the U.S. can exert moral leadership on Gulf states or regional allies that we have there, how will that kind of lessen the violence and lead to, you know, a better resolution?
Well, that in combination with improving our relationship with, for example, Iran, which fortunately we're starting to do on the nuclear talks, but we have to understand that Iran is a major player in what's going to happen in Syria. The Iranians, of course, are concerned about the Shiites in general, not just the Alawis, who are a breakaway sect, but there are other Shia in the country. And they are going to, I attended a conference recently where I was told by someone very high up that, in fact, the Iranians are eager to compromise on this issue. That their concern is to continue to have friendly relations with whoever is going to be the regime in Syria, and to make sure that the Shias are protected, and they have no particular support for Assad himself. Mm-hmm. So what they don't want, and what the Russians also don't want, is to see Syria kicked out of being an ally with them into being an ally with the United States. Whereas as far as the despotism in Syria is concerned, they're not interested in supporting that. So if we were to adopt the position that, okay, we're not insisting that we have to put in an American puppet regime in Syria, all we want to see is that the despot should go, and we are perfectly willing to see whatever safeguards are necessary in order for the Alawites and the Shias and the Christians and the Kurds, by the way, to be protected, then that would be great. That actually I think both the Russians and the Iranians would be interested in cooperating. And once they put pressure on Assad, he can't stay.
We started talking about how kind of capitalism or a mercantilist version of that is equated in many parts of the Muslim world with the West. Do they also see communism or a kind of centrally controlled command and control economy as equally as a Western invasion or an imperial initiative in their worlds?
Absolutely. We have to remember that the Mujahideen's initial enemy in Afghanistan was the Soviets, and that they were fighting to expel the foreign system that had been imposed upon them by the Soviet Union. After the Soviets left and the Americans came in, they just, turned all that against the capitalist system.
Well, this probably a thornier question even than Syria. What, the U.S. is slowly pulling out of Afghanistan. What's the best thing that the West can do to kind of, make Afghanistan a better place?
I think the best thing the West can do for Afghanistan and for many other countries that are in similar situations is to allow people-to-people exchanges. Especially because we have a substantial Muslim community in the United States, but also there are other communities in the United States that have expertise of various kinds that the Afghanis would love to have access to. What they don't want is someone coming in from the position of power and saying, we're going to impose this on you. You know, even to the degree that Afghanistan has moved towards a more democratic system since the time of the Soviet occupation, it was through the development of the Loya Jirga, which is an intrinsic, inherent Afghani method of dealing with governance that even allowed Karzai, to come into power. So basically, I think that we have to stop thinking it as a nation state to nation state and start viewing people to people relationships. Right now, there are organizations that are engaged in helping, the Afghanis develop it with whether it's schools, whether it's conflict resolution. And the Afghanis have, because they come in with respect for the local culture, the Afghanis have never resisted their support. At least not, I mean, sometimes they may resist initially, but that resistance melts as soon as they realize people are sincere.
Libertarianism seems to be on the rise in the U.S. Younger people seem to be more socially tolerant and fiscally conservative, or, however we want to phrase it. Are you finding libertarianism, is it gaining a foothold in the, either in the American Muslim community or worldwide?
It's gaining, not as fast as I'd like to see it gain, but there are more and more people who are identifying themselves as libertarians, who are saying they're voting for libertarian candidates, and people who are opening up to, if not downright embracing, libertarian ideals. Unfortunately, the numbers are still tiny, so that people still are not willing to buy the whole cake. They are willing to concede increasingly on point after point. And I think that the question is, and to acknowledge the attractiveness of the underlying libertarian principle. There's still a hesitation, as you see with the American public, but if we take it whole, what are we buying into? I think Bill Buckley was the one who said that libertarian brew is bracing when sipped and lethal when swallowed whole. I'm afraid that's the way too many Muslims view it. But again, I think the more time goes on, the more they begin to see the value of these ideas.
All right. Well, great. We'll leave it there. I want to thank Imad Ad-Din Ahmad. He's the president and founder of the Minaret of Freedom Institute. Thanks so much for talking to us today.
My pleasure.
For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie.